This next particular one is fun because it's going to stretch your brain a little bit and help you really think about applying some of the weird passages we read.
The ancient people called the movement from one constellation to the next in the great year, they called it an age. I'm giving amillennialists permission to think like dispensationalists without them being dispensational.
Welcome to Kingdoms Unveiled. We have two pastors who are excited about the gospel of Jesus Christ because we actually believe that it's powerful. We believe that it can bring people to life. It tears down strongholds. And there is an entire army called the Domain of Darkness that wants to stop us and everyone else from talking about it. There's real evil in the world. The Bible tells us about it. And that's what this podcast is about. So we're going to talk about the kingdom of darkness as it wars against the kingdom of light. And as we stand firm in the strength of the Lord, putting on the armor of God, that's what we want to do every week. So your hosts are Douglas Van Dorn, Doug Van Dorn. I don't think I've ever called you Douglas. Doug Van Dorn is the pastor of the Reformed Baptist Church in Boulder, Colorado. And I am John Moffin, the pastor of Grace Reformed Church in Spring Hill, Tennessee. If you'd like to learn more about Doug and his plethora of books that he's written and articles, you can go to douglasvandorn.com. And if you'd like to learn more about me and my ministries, you can go to johnmoffitt.com. Doug, before we jump in, most likely, Lord willing, by his sovereign grace, there might be a place for people to go and ask some questions and have a community and find more resources by the time this podcast comes out. What is this? What is this place, this mysterious place they can go to?
We're hopeful for it. Called the Reformed. Yeah. We're calling it the Reformed Fringe. Mm.
It's such a great name.
Reformed Fringe. So, you know, I get all these emails from all these people and a lot of pastors.
Yeah.
They're saying, man, I don't know anybody else that's talking about this stuff. I can't talk about this with anybody that I know. Can you please, like, what can we do about that? And exactly. So we decided that, well, maybe we can put together a little community and at the very least have it be a place where people can network with each other.
Sure.
See that they're not the only people out there, but also We want people to be able to feel free to talk about all the questions that we raise in this podcast, questions that are being raised on other podcasts that people are listening to, like, mm-hmm. you know, Blurry Creatures that I've been on many times and those kinds of things where people are talking about things. You know, I think about Tony Merkel's podcast. He gets mm-hmm. into some really weird stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know,
how do you process that?
Yeah. How do you process it that? And is it possible to do it from a Reformed worldview, or is this just incompatible? And we fully believe that the Reformed worldview is the best way that you can understand the scripture. And so therefore it should be the best way that you can understand the world around you. And we don't want to shy away from these kind of topics, but we know that it can be tough out there. And so mm-hmm. we're putting it behind a paywall so that people can have a little bit more freedom and our ability to kind of police things. And we, you know, we have all kinds of resources that we're going to want to give out and, mm-hmm. and make available to people and
yep.
Bring guests on, and the sky's really the limit, and people can, yep. you know, even help us kind of drive where they want it to go. So
yeah,
that, like, this is really a deal that's in the works, and we're hoping that by the time this podcast gets out there, that hopefully it'll be available.
Man, we're grassroots. It's a great system. But where this will go, there's a lot of influence. So we'd love to have.
There's going
to
be a lot of growth on this thing. Like we're not setting it up fully ready to go.
No,
because we want people to be able to start connecting with each other right away.
Yeah. So if you're like, hey, that sounds awesome, you can go to douglasvandorn.com or johnmoffitt.com, and we'll have some links. More information.
Yeah.
Most of the information will be there. We're still working on securing a web address for it, but it's the Reformed Fringe. That's what you're going to look for. The Reformed Fringe. And man, we're excited. It's going to be fun. I don't know about you, man, but some of these online groups, they can get wild and they turn into like nasty debates. We don't want that.
No, we don't.
We want that.
We want to keep this thing positive and thinking about things, giving people the freedom to think about them, but not attacking each other. And, you know, kind of what we've tried to make our ministries about.
I've been so scarred when you said positive and encouraging K-Love.
Since I don't listen to K-Love, I listen to old school rock. I wouldn't know what you're talking about.
You knew exactly what I was talking about as soon as I said it. They got good advertising.
That's the extent of my K-Love, man.
There you go. Oh, this is not a professional program. Speaking of, all right, we're excited. Moving on. All right. So those are all of our advertisements. All right. Look, I'm going to warn the listener ahead of time. This is a good topic, but it's going to stretch your thinking a little bit. And this is why the group, I know it's just like turning into a podcast to advertise the group, but seriously though, Doug, when people hear this and they're like, okay, I've got like 10 questions.
Yeah, great. They will for this one.
I know. Then come in and ask them. And look, we'll put it to you this way. If you can't afford it, then just let us know. We'll get you in there. So we'll figure out how to get you in there. We don't want, you know, if money's an issue, we'll figure it out. But Doug. This next one, I remember, you know, you talk about finding people, they're like, oh my gosh, you believe this as well. I remember the first day you and I were on the phone, and I think I shot you with about 90 questions because I was like, I need to figure out where we don't agree. And I was like, all right, I figured it out. We're on the same page. This is awesome. Like, I'm not crazy. And I know many of you are listening to this podcast and you're realizing, man, I'm not crazy. And that's a good place to be. This next particular one is fun because it's going to stretch your brain a little bit and help you really think about applying some of the weird passages we read that are like, man, I don't know what to do with that. Like, how do I interpret this in light of scripture? And that is this one about the ages and the age to come. This can be really confusing. So you're going to walk us through some work that you've done. And this is fun. I'm excited for it. I'm going to ask a lot of questions that I know I had. And questions I think I still have. So talk us through age and age to come and how to understand that.
Okay, so we brought up the age and the age to come, the present age, the present evil age, and the age mm-hmm. to come last time. We mentioned it. And that was really something that got me out of that whole dispensational, premillennial, speculative stuff and really started grounding me in the already... Not yet of the yep. kingdom of God. Okay. Mm-hmm. So when we read our guys, and I highly recommend reading Voss, if you can understand him, Gerhardus Voss, or Richard Gaffin.
Gaffin's probably going to be easier.
Talking about this stuff. It's just phenomenal, fantastic stuff. And, mm-hmm. and it's not just our amillennial guys, but there's historic primo guys who talk about this, like George Ladd. There's plenty of postmill guys that talk about it. It's a pretty well-established idea of there being two ages. Mm-hmm. And in that idea, the present age or the present evil age really began with Adam and then mm-hmm. carries on until the second coming of Jesus. The age to come is very bizarre because you wouldn't think this would be the case unless you understand that the kingdom is not a physical kingdom. It's not a place you can observe and say, where is it? It's over here. It's over there. Like Jesus said, but it's a kingdom that's within your midst. It's a spiritual kingdom. And this kingdom or age to come began at the first coming of Jesus mm-hmm. and was really, really technically, I suppose, begins at Pentecost with the sending of the Holy Spirit. But you can kind of view it as coming in stages in some ways because Jesus' ministry is certainly a foreshadowing of it. But what that means is you have this huge overlap of time where you're in the age to come and the present age at the same time. And that creates all kinds of weird, bizarre tensions that you guys can deal with over on Theocast, John.
Sounds good.
So that's kind of been my training in the two ages. Then I came across a very, very interesting comment from the church father Origen as I was doing my study on Revelation 20, verses 7 through 10. Now, this is the passage where Satan is let loose for a little period. It's called the little season of mm-hmm. Satan. And it really doesn't say much other than he's let loose to attack the church. And then as soon as he tries, he's basically defeated and thrown into the lake of fire, and then it's over. So Origen says something really interesting. He says, if I may offer a conjecture on so great a matter, I think that as the last month is the end of the year, after which the beginning of another month ensues, so it may be that since several ages complete, as it were, a year of ages, the present age is the end after which certain ages to come will ensue, of which the age to come is the beginning. In those coming ages, God will show the riches of his grace and kindness. Now, you're reading that and going, what did you just say?
Yeah.
Well, let me give you the background behind this. Origen is noticing that in the New Testament, it sometimes doesn't use the terminology age, but it talks about past ages. And it doesn't just use age to come singular, but ages to come, which implies that there's more than just the two that we talked about a minute ago. And so what Origen is doing is he's putting his insanely brilliant mind to work using something that he calls a formula that has been known about for a long time that regards something that scientists talk about as precession or the great year. Now, so far, all this stuff sounds really bizarre. And like, why are you even bringing this up for a topic of the coming of Satan? So let's back it up a minute. And let's think about what we've said with regard to Revelation 19, 20, and going into 20. So you have this battle at the end of chapter 19. And then we've argued that it goes back to the beginning and Satan is bound. And then it gives you a earthly and then a heavenly perspective of that in verses 4-6 of this millennial period that we're in presently. And then you have this loosing of Satan and another battle. And it struck me, John, that all the eschatological views that we talked about last time, doesn't matter, all of them, pre-mill, post-mill, all-mill. They all believe that prior to, or well, after the millennium, okay, there's going to be some kind of a battle that takes place. And then you will have the ushering in of the eternal state, essentially. Now, from our perspective as amillennialists, we can read the entire book of Revelation through the lens of this final battle. If you read the book cyclically, I think it demands that it be read this way, so that what you're reading in chapter 20, verses 7 through 10, has actually been discussed many times already in various ways in the various battles and crazy things that happen throughout the book up to that moment in time.
Right.
Okay. So what that means is that we all believe that something bad is coming in the future as it regards Satan. Some of us might put it 1,000 years from now. Some of us might put it 7 years from now, whatever the case, 1 year from now, I don't know. But we all believe that there's something like that. Some people might believe that there's two of them. Some people might believe that there's 10 of them. But we all believe that at before the end of time, there's something that unifies all the beliefs, which is that Satan is let loose. He goes to attack the church. And then Jesus gets the final victory. Now, when Jesus starts telling his disciples at this sermon on Olivet Discourse, okay, on the Mount of Olives, they ask him a question, and I pull this up because I'll get Matthew's version of it for us. So Jesus leaves the temple, he's going away when his disciples come to point out the buildings of the temple, and he answers them, "You see all these things, do you not? And truly I say you, there not be one left here or stone upon another that will not be thrown down." As he sat on the Mount of Olives, this is Matthew 24:3, the disciples came to him privately saying, "Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming at the end of the age?" Boom, 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 drum roll right there. Age, you hear that?
Yeah.
The word age. This is the key thing to why I'm bringing up these, what Origen just talked about. So when you hear the end of the age as a dispensationalist, you're thinking, oh, the end of the church age, right at the end of the tribulation, right before the millennium. When you hear that language as somebody steeped into a two-age eschatology, you basically, your mind goes to the end right before Jesus returns for the eternal state.
Right.
Neither one, well, dispensationalists might be, they might actually be a little bit more objective than the other folks in terms of when would that be? Do we have any kind of a sign of this at all, right? So, well, Jesus goes and he gives this whole sermon. And of course, the sermon has been totally discussed and disagreed upon when he's talking about. And I happen to take a view that sees the first half of the sermon as being already fulfilled in 70 AD, the second half of the sermon as being fulfilled sometime in the future. Mm-hmm. And I do that because I think that the disciples may have thought they were asking one question. The one question is, when will these things be and what will be the sign of your coming at the end of the age?
Right.
But Jesus sees it as two questions. When will these things be? What things? The stones not left on the temple.
Right.
And the second question, what will be the sign of your coming at the end of the age? So he answers the first part of that by giving them really specific things to look for. When you see the arm in this, this is the way Luke puts it. When you see the armies surrounding Jerusalem, run to the hills because you know that the time is now.
Right.
And guess what? Well, in 69 AD or whatever, a bunch of Christians that were inside Jerusalem saw that sign and they went, fled for the hills. Then the Romans entered the city and they murdered over 1 million Jews and no Christians were killed. Hmm. Why? Because they understood Jesus was talking about that moment. Mm-hmm. But Jesus then talks about what will be the coming at the sign of your coming at the end of the age. And he starts to give, you know, more kind of cryptic information about that that is for a different podcast.
Right.
What I want to focus on is what in the world does it mean by the end of the age? And is this just something that's just out there that we can never really know, that we always are just speculating on, that it's always driven by newspapers and just driven by don't worry about it, don't think about it, don't talk about it? And that's where Origen comes in, because Origen goes to something that's very objective and something that was well known to the Romans and the Jews, both in science and in theology, mm-hmm. which is a very specific meaning of the word age that I have never heard any of our guys talk about, because I don't think that they know it exists. And that is that an age refers to a period of time on something called the great year, the great clock. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. So what in the world is that? So you need to kind of wrap your head around something. And I spend a whole chapter in the book talking about this in Rings of Revelation. We'll also talk about this, Judd and I, in our new book on the Dragon of Damascus. We'll go into it even more. But basically what you have, think about a solar year. Okay. A solar year is how long it takes the Earth to go around its orbit around the sun and return to the same place. Mm-hmm. So it goes from, say, January 1st, 1 year to January 1st, the next year. And now you're back and now you begin a new solar year.
Right.
That's 365 days. That year, by the way, is divided into 12 months. Mm-hmm. And those 12 months are objectively put up in the sky by God in the form of constellations. Mm-hmm. So these are the 12 constellations that are called the zodiac. This has nothing to do with astrology, by the way. It's purely Genesis 1. God put the stars there for signs and for seasons so that people mm-hmm. would know when to plant their crops, when to harvest them, when to, you know, all that kind of stuff. Because if you didn't know this, you know, people didn't have computers, people didn't have calendars, all that kind of stuff back in the day. They had to be perfectly in alignment and understanding what was going on outside around them. And the stars are what told them that. Right. And you've been in a really hot day, right? Where it's 70 degrees and the next day it snows.
Yeah.
Like, what if you get caught off guard by that? You're in trouble. So you have to know the calendar. And God gave us those 12 months for this solar calendar. There's another calendar that's...
Hey, real quick, is that where the phrase come when the stars align?
When the stars align? Maybe.
Like, you know what I'm talking about? Like, you're waiting for the stars to align. You're waiting for the stars to get... Because if you're
talking about... To the point where they were at. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. So there's another year that we can talk about that's a much longer period of time. In fact, it takes 26,000 solar years for it to complete one cycle. Now, how does this work? We have to understand that the Earth is rotating on a vertical axis, right? Mm-hmm. Spins around this axis. One revolution around its axis is called a day. However, this axis is not perfectly vertical. It's tilted. Mm-hmm. And that tilt when you look at the tilt, it points up at in the sky at a star. Today, that star is called Polaris, or the North Star. Mm-hmm. And that's how we define where north is, and that's how you can figure out longitude. That's how you can figure out navigation.
Right.
So the thing is, this spinning goes around in a circle this way as it points north. Mm-hmm. And for it to take one revolution to go from pointing to Polaris today to Polaris again takes 26,000 years. That's incredibly slow amount of time. Okay. And so if you can imagine a top that you spin, mm-hmm. you spin that top at the beginning, it's perfectly vertical, right? But as it starts to slow down, it starts to wobble, and that top vertical axis starts to go like this, right?
Yep.
In this kind mm-hmm. of circular motion. That's mm-hmm. what we're talking about. How long does it take for the sun to, or for the earth to return to that point in time? In fact, people don't understand this, but there's actually been many North Stars over the course of the last few thousand years, because it doesn't always point at Polaris, because it's changing. It changes according to.
Well, I guess it depends on if the earth is flat or not.
And it doesn't matter if you believe the earth is flat, because this is what it is. Like, this is just is. All the ancients knew this. They encoded it into their architecture. So there you go.
I'm sorry. I've been waiting on podcasts to throw that one at you. Okay. So that's new information.
Okay.
That we've had different North Stars, which has nothing to do with the Bible. I mean, it does, but that's just new scientific.
Yeah, most people think that the North Star is always the North Star. It's not.
Interesting.
12,000 years ago, the North Star was Vega, which is in the constellation Lyra, which is way far away from the North Star that we have today. Why? Because they are spinning on an axis. Now,
okay.
Here's the
thing. 26,000 years.
26,000 years. That's just a rough number. There's a sacred number and there's an actual number. I'm just using 26,000 years for fun. Mm-hmm. 24,000 might be even easier for people's brains to wrap their head around, because what happens is that over the course of this great year, as you move through time, now, mm-hmm. One day in this great year would be, 360, if it's a circle, 360 degrees in a circle, one degree of movement takes 72 years to move 1 degree. So basically, you'll never see this move in your lifetime.
Yeah.
It's that slow of a clock.
Right.
However, if you go back 2,000 years, you find that there is a significant change. And in fact, this is marked by the rising of different constellations on the same day of the year each year. Mm-hmm. So for example, if you were to go out today and you were to go, well, let's say you were to go out on the spring equinox on March 21st, and you were to look directly east at sunrise, you would see a certain constellation rising.
Okay.
Okay. That constellation would be rising in your field of view on that same day, March 21st, the next year, the next year, the next year. It would be there for your entire lifetime. However, if you go 2,000 years into the future, it will rise in the next constellation over. And if you go in 2,000 years in the past, it'll rise in the next constellation behind it. So basically, this large calendar is working like the small calendar, the solar year, according to the 12 constellations.
Right.
And here's why all this matters. It's because the ancient people called the movement from one constellation to the next in the great year, they called it an age.
Interesting.
Now, you've heard of the age of Aquarius. Mm-hmm. From the 60s song. This is the dawning of the age of Aquarius. And that's been associated with all kinds of new age stuff. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All the age of Aquarius is, in terms of what we're talking about here, is that right now the Earth is somewhere between Pisces and Aquarius in terms of where it's rising on that specific day each year. Mm-hmm. However, 200 to 300 years from now, it will be 100% apparent that it is now Aquarius. Whereas 300 years ago, it was completely apparent that it was in Pisces. Now, why does that matter? Well, if you go back to the earliest church, you see that there's some really interesting things. They called, Jesus talks about making people fishers of men. Mm-hmm. You see on their baptismal fonts, they called their fonts little fish ponds. You find that Christians would greet one another as with a secret mark on a road with a sign of a fish. Mm-hmm. And in fact, even the ichthus that people to this day put on the back of their car became an acronym for something like Jesus Christ, Lord, Savior. Mm-hmm. But it was spelled out ichthus, which is means a fish. Why? Why would they do this? It's because the age of Pisces was beginning when Jesus came to be born. And here's where this gets really weird. Virgil, who was one of the three great...
I got to ask a question.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
For the listener. You got to make the connection there. Ichthus, the fish, and the age of Pisces. How does that connect?
Well, a fish... Pisces is the constellation of the fish.
Got it. Didn't right? know that. Now I do.
Okay. And Aquarius is the constellation of a man.
Okay.
Pouring water out of a bucket. So if you just go and look at your... If you go look at your signs on a zodiac, you'll see that they each represent something.
Okay.
Gemini is the twins, or Taurus is a bull, or whatever the case is. Mm-hmm. So in the first century BC, there was an epic poet, Roman poet named Virgil, who a lot of the church fathers kind of called the prophet of Christianity. And he prophesied apparently the coming of Jesus by saying, "The last age by the Sibyl sung has come and gone, and the majestic roll of circling centuries begins anew when this particular man will be born." What's he mean? The last age has come and gone, and the circling centuries begins anew. What he's talking about there is the great year. Mm-hmm. And he's saying that we just left the age of Aries the ram. We're coming into the last age of Pisces. Now, here's where it gets really wild. Pisces would be considered the 12th month of the great year. Mm-hmm. It would be like December of the great year, and it would last for 2,000 years before it begins over on January 1st, which just happens to be the constellation Aquarius. They referred to this, the Jews talked about this too. There's a book called Fourth Ezra, where they give this weird prophecy: for the age has lost its youth, that would be the age of Aries, and the time begin to grow old, for the age is divided into 12 parts, and 9 parts have already passed, as well as half a 10th part, and 2 of its parts remain besides half of the 10th part. Here he's actually dividing that age of the month into 12 parts itself, so that you can go 2,000 years, and you go, what is 9 parts of that? And you come to about 450 BC, 2.5 parts remain. That's about 450 years left. All fits kind of exactly when the book was being written and the prophecies were taking place. The point is, they're calling this an age, John. Hmm. And it was objective and it was measurable. And you would know when, roughly speaking, when one begins and when one ends.
By the stars.
By the stars. Exactly. And so when Jesus is talking about the end of, when they're talking about the end of the age, it's very plausible to me that these disciples knew full well that they were beginning the age of Pisces. So what will mark the end of the age? When you will return? And the idea would be, okay, I'm going to return at the end of the age. When would that be? Sometime at the end of the age of Pisces. Right at the beginning of the new year, this new great procession year that takes 26,000 years to go around one full revolution. This is so weird to me, because of all the times that this could have happened, the only one it would have worked is the age of Pisces. If you go back 2,000 years to Abraham, doesn't work, because Aries is not the end of the year. You have another, that's November. That's not December.
Right.
Okay. If you go back to, if you go 2,000 years into our future, it doesn't work, because you're just kind of, you're in February. That's not going to end anything.
Right.
But Aquarius, that this crazy new age thing that these new agers have really co-opted from what God has created to be the way that this, the earth runs on its cycles, its great course. Aquarius begins January of a month and it begins a new year. Now, what that means, practically speaking, is that it seems to me that if this is the terminology that's in mind in the New Testament writers, when they're talking about many ages to come, or when Jesus says the end of the age, that you wouldn't have something like, I remember when the 88 Reasons Why Jesus Will Return in 88 guy came out and he goes, well, yeah, Jesus says no one can know the day or the
hour
or the hour, but you can know the weekend. So he goes, sometime during the Feast of Tabernacles during 1988, Jesus will return. That was his deal.
The weekend.
This is not that.
Yeah.
To mark the beginning of the age of Aquarius, nobody knows when it technically begins or ends. Some people think that Aquarius began 100 years ago. Some people think it began on December 21st, 2012. Some people think that it won't begin for another 100 years. This is because it takes so long for that thing to go. And the constellations are gigantic, enormous things.
Is that related to the 2012 movie?
Yeah. And 2012 movie was actually rooted off of this kind of myth of a Mayan calendar coming to an end.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So
yeah.
They're all playing on the same kind of an idea. And what's so interesting to me about it is that if this is right, then it actually gives us some kind of an objective time frame within a period of 150, 200 years to be looking for this little season of the release of Satan and for the return of Christ. That being said, we are in that period of time right now, and we will be likely for another 50 to 100 years, which makes... to me, the speculations that are so rampant in dispensationalism or even in kind of secular versions with transhumanism and all the weird stuff that humans are doing right now, it makes it kind of wild to me because it's like, I could actually kind of get there, but a totally different way than you are getting there. I'm not getting there from what I think is a misreading of eschatology. I'm actually getting there through a literal understanding of what the Romans and the Jews understood to be the definition of an age.
Okay. I got a lot of questions.
Go for it, man.
All right. So you've got the New Testament apostles. You're arguing that they would have understood the age and the age to come. Like that phrase would have made sense to them. Is this correct?
Yeah. Now, I think that the New Testament is complicated because I think that the New Testament uses age and age to come in more than one sense.
Which is fair. Okay. So then what would be so the one you just argued would be based upon the stars.
Right. The other one is based more upon the age, the present evil age and the age to come is based more upon a human timeline from Adam to the second coming of Christ.
Mm-hmm. So that phrase can be used. Have you looked? Is that the same Greek phrase?
It's the same word. Yeah.
Yeah. 100%. So the same word could be used in a literal sense where he is speaking about the actual calendar age.
Right.
Or a figurative sense.
Right. Where it's talking about the age of the first Adam and the second Adam, if you want to put it that way.
Right. So it's not necessarily putting a time period on other than this section and that section.
So when you see something like Hebrews 1:2 telling us that we are in the last days now, okay, the last days began with Jesus. This is classic two-age eschatology that the second coming of Jesus or the first coming of Jesus ushered in these last days. But kind of strangely, there's still the last days, kind of like December 1st all the way through December 31st are the last days of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And those began with the first coming of Jesus.
Right. So that kind of leads to my second question of, it seems like the New Testament writers were anticipating the return of Christ at any moment during their time 2,000 years ago.
Some people have made that argument. I don't know that everybody believed that was the case. And furthermore, I don't know that everybody had to understand this meaning of an age in order for God to have that meaning of an age. Right? This is the same problem that you find with prophecy of Jesus and his first coming. Mm-hmm. It was plainly written. It doesn't mean everybody understood what they were reading. And in fact, almost nobody understood what they were reading.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't mean that it wasn't still plainly there. And it seems to me it makes good historical sense that you could have a definition of an age that was actually known to Jews and to Greeks and to Romans that you would use as one of the definitions of when you're talking about, for example, the end of the age. Why wouldn't you?
Mm-hmm. So let's say they did understand this. Then the anticipation was basically like, which is, I think, this sentiment we're supposed to have. It's like, hey, look, you're going to try and figure out when he's coming back. Don't do that. Don't waste your time doing that. With Jesus' point being, no man knows the day or the hour. In other words, could the understanding of it be when he's doing this? Because there's a couple of passages, you know, talked about a thief in the night. You know, when he's coming, it's going to be a surprise to us or whatever. The anticipation is two things. One, he is coming. That is for sure. We know that to be a fact. I mean, Peter's encouraging. I'm just thinking about 2 Peter right now. But it is a future event, and we don't know exactly when that event's going to be. So you can have the hope, but realizing it could happen in any moment. We don't know. I guess what I'm trying to get at is if they had a proper understanding of this, how would they interpret that in their writings and encouragement to the church? I'm getting really technical here.
So you're asking the question, I think that there's a presupposition that's going on.
Oh, totally.
In the way that the question is being asked.
Yeah, for sure.
That I don't know that I would necessarily even buy into the presupposition in the first place.
How did the New Testament writers talk about the coming of Christ?
Well, they all, how would you answer that question?
Well, and again, this is based upon my training, but it seems like it was imminent at any moment. Like, he could come back at any moment. So he is coming back, and it could be at any moment, but we don't know exactly when it's going to be. That's how I've understood it.
What? Give me a passage that would cause you to think that.
No, you can't put me on the spot. I'm putting you on the spot.
Exactly. Well, this is kind of the point, is that...
Right. This is what I'm trying to get at.
The New Testament authors are always warning the Christians to behave as if Jesus could return at any time.
This is true. Right.
That's my point. And maybe they did believe that Jesus could return at any time, which would mean either that this idea of an age being a month of the great year is simply not true, or it could mean that they didn't understand that that's what it was actually talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So they could have thought that the end of the age and the beginning of the age would have taken a grand total of 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I suppose they could have thought that way.
Right. Yeah, I guess that's kind of like, I'm just fleshing out some of the stuff because I'm hearing what you're saying.
For all practical purposes, yeah. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Scholars have been, like, skeptics jump on what you're talking about right here. To say, well, see, they didn't even know what they were talking about. And they were just wrong. Right? How many
people... Yeah, like, what does the phrase mean, the Lord is at hand? What does that mean?
Well, there's many days of the Lord. That's a totally different subject. The day of the Lord was on Israel when they went into exile and captivity.
Okay.
Okay, so there's many kind of days of the Lord. I don't have a problem with that. Well, we're talking about the actual second coming, the ushering in of the eternal state here.
Mm-hmm. Oh, like, all right. So James, when he closes his letter, you also be patient, establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. That seems to get, it depends on how you interpret is at hand.
And it depends what you mean by the day of the Lord too. Like, there could be.
Says for the coming of the Lord is what it says. The coming of the Lord.
Is that parousia?
That's a good question. I don't know. I'd have to look it up.
Yeah, or is it erchomai? Because those are two different words that are being used in the Greek to talk about different forms of coming.
Stop tearing down my arguments. I've got good ones here. The word that he uses for the parousia, for the coming of the Lord. Yeah.
Okay, so you can make an argument there. So let's say that James, you know, this is what a skeptic would say is, see, James thought that the second coming was at hand, and it wasn't. He was wrong. So the Bible's full of lies.
Right. Which is not the argument I'm making. What I'm saying is I'm trying to connect the two in my mind with what you're saying is if they're saying is at hand, if they're in this period that you're talking about, James could be saying the coming of the Lord is in this period. is at hand. Like, it's here. But when it happens in here, we don't know.
It could be. I think that's pushing what I'm saying, because James would, I mean, you're assuming that James would have known about the great year and that he would have known, you know, that's not an assumption I'm willing to even make.
Okay.
I think John knew about the great year. I could argue that. I don't know about James. But when you make that kind of an argument, like, if he would have known about the great year, he would have said, no, man, we're like on January 5th right now. We have 2,000 years before this even comes close to being fulfilled, right?
Right.
What's so interesting to me, though, is I go back to a guy like Origen. So Origen's mm-hmm. living just 200 years after James.
Mm-hmm.
And Origen is making this argument, really seemingly for the first time in church history, that he goes, it puzzles me. You know, how can we have this age and the age to come, and yet we also have many ages in the past and many ages in the future? Mm-hmm. And his reconciliation of that is that sometimes the word age is talking about the months of the great year.
So using John's reference, Origen's conclusion, your conclusion is that we're in that period.
Well, it's not a conclusion. It's truth. It's just simply is what it is. We are in that period. Now, it doesn't mean that the word age has this meaning.
Right.
That will be proven true within 200 years. Like, if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. And I don't really care if I'm right or wrong or not.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is that why would I even bring all this up? Why does it even matter to me? Let me give you a couple of reasons. First thing is, it's a really interesting way to help people who believe in eschatology to see that maybe we're all not all as far apart as a lot of people like to make us think that we are,
mm-hmm.
or that we don't have to be that far apart. My first point being, we all believe in a little season of Satan at mm-hmm. some point in the future before the second coming. I don't know anybody who really talks about that, John, and it bothers me, because mm-hmm. that's focusing on something we all agree on. Second of all, given what I'm talking about here, we could all actually objectively look at the time frame that we're living in and going, we have really good reasons to think that we're living in crazy, crazy days that are unprecedented, that God's going to put an end to. Kind of mm-hmm. like the days before the flood, when he gives Noah 120 years and then it's over. Like,
mm-hmm.
like, I'm going to give you 120 years, but then it's over. He told them about that ahead of time. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And third of all, it's not using speculation. It's not going into a literalistic, physical interpretation of Revelation to do it. It's simply using a word that had a very well-known, established meaning mm-hmm. at the time in the New Testament, and saying, what if the New Testament actually means that when it's mm-hmm. talking about the second coming? Whether or not the apostles understood that is a different question. But if this was the intent that God had when he had these guys use this word aeon so that it could be put there, then maybe it behooves us to be taking our dispensational brothers a little bit more seriously when they're actually looking at events in the world right now and going, yeah, this is really not normal, you know, as opposed to just saying, I don't want to have anything to do with what you're talking about because I know that your hermeneutic is all messed up.
Yeah, no, I like what you're saying, because this happens on both sides, right? We do this. I don't like some of your conclusions, so all your conclusions are wrong. And that's ridiculous. We have to be careful never to do that. But no, it is interesting. You know, you have both sides. Like, I talk to some postmillennialists and they're like, man, the world's never been greater. And I'm like, I don't know what he's talking about. It's pretty dark.
So, now, it's just me and my past dispensationalism going, yeah, there's still a negative streak in me, even though I like to call myself optimistic amil, because I'm very hopeful for the future in terms of what's coming.
Yeah.
But I don't know if what's coming is going to be kind of in my mind, something that would be like a second birth of America, like a new revolution, just totally physical like that. Or if maybe Jesus is going to come back, and I don't know, but I'm still optimistic about it. But at the same time, I'm very pessimistic about human nature and really always will be.
Well, I mean, this podcast is totally going in a direction I didn't think it was going to go. We'll talk about it anyways, but can't both be true at the same time, where there's a There's a craziness of evil and yet a rise of salvation.
Well, this is why we're all millennialists, isn't it? Because we can actually believe that Satan is prowling around like a lion seeking to destroy many.
Yeah.
At the same time that he is bound from deceiving the nations so that God will save people.
And hasn't in church history proven that when evil arises, that the gospel flourishes?
Exactly. And let me make a point about the little season, because I think this is not thought about well enough by some people. When you read that particular part of it, so this is Revelation 20, starting in 7. When the 1,000 years are ended, Satan will be released from his prison. So what I'm arguing is that it's possible Satan has been released from his prison. But that does not mean that he is able to deceive every one of the people in the nations again. Because look what it says. He will come out to deceive the nations that are at the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them for battle. Their numbers like the sand of the sea. And they marched up over the broad plain of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints. Well, how do you do that if he's deceiving everybody and there's nobody who's saved anymore?
That's right.
Doesn't make any sense. So I think people might be reading too much into even that little season, that maybe even if he has been released or will shortly be released or whatever the case might be and what we're talking about here, you still have the power of the gospel to save people until the very, very end of all things.
All right. I'll bring even more practical application in that you can say when you see when you see a rise of evil and hostility towards Christianity, which is very evident in scripture, and I would say evident to today, that we can attribute it to our, like we can look at the Bible and say, we know where that comes from. We can attribute that to Satan. This is my question.
Is that a question?
That was a statement question.
It was a statement question. Yeah. I mean,
from a practical standpoint, what I'm saying is like this, it's super fascinating. But at the end of the day, like, how does it matter? Going back to that question of how does it matter? And what you're saying is, hey, the Bible actually tells us and explains to us what's going on. That's your point.
And Revelation, this isn't the only place. So if we're reading Revelation, this part of Revelation in conjunction with the others, you find Christians and Satan loosed at the same time throughout the whole book, mm-hmm. for crying out loud.
Right.
So, you know, to get to practical to what you asked about the apostles, my answer would be that if I'm right, I would still answer the exact same way that the apostles would answer about how you're supposed to live your life and what you're supposed to be thinking about with regard to the return of Christ. Live a godly life, expect him to return, be faithful to him, don't blaspheme him, tell other people about him. He's coming, you know?
That's right. That's right. Well, and that's helpful because that makes it does make sense, because it doesn't matter if you fully understand exactly when he's coming back or not, the responsibility of the believer doesn't change. Like if we knew Jesus was coming back tomorrow or next year, does it change our responsibility according to the text?
Doesn't change your responsibility, but it would change the way a lot of people would live.
Which is kind of their point, I think, in them saying, you don't really know. It's like a thief in the night. You don't know.
And that's one of my points here with this, is that we don't know. Like to have a 200-year period of time of when this thing could happen, that's really not knowing anything, honestly.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Other than that, okay, within 300 years, it will be either right or wrong.
Right.
But I won't be here to worry about that. So.
And at the end of the day, like, and what I think is fascinating, what you're saying is that there's a lot of interesting connections here, and we can see that we do have the capacity because of where we're at with the internet and history books. We can compare history and how evil things were to today. And there does seem like, man, there are definitely some eerie evil periods, but it just, I don't know. It seems pretty bad. Might say, well, look at what's going on in the United States. Things are getting better. I'm like, yeah, well, maybe.
Well, yeah. I mean, what if Satan has been let loose? What if we're seeing a proliferation of paganism and a return of the gods and it's return of supernatural evil in a way that we have not seen in the Western world since before the coming of the gospel to the Western people?
Mm-hmm. I mean, the days of Noah.
Yeah. I mean, so that, like, that kind of, to me, what it does is it just gives me an ability in my mind to try and make sense of some things that otherwise I can't make sense of at all. And I would rather try and make sense of it than to just be completely in the dark and fuzzy about it. Even if my conclusions and the way that I live my life ends up being practically the same, it sure is satisfying to be able to have some kind of answer that goes, okay, that explains it from a biblical point of view, why this could be happening.
Yeah. And there's no reason to be discouraged as if, oh, well, our work isn't going to be ineffective because Satan's at work. That's actually opposite of that.
Exactly. Like one of the things that dispensationalism really, I think people like about it is it makes them feel like, okay, I've got a biblical reason for thinking all these things. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, that's very satisfying.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of helping people, wanting to help people see that maybe you can have that same kind of a sense without doing some of the stuff that we think is not where Revelation and the rest of the Bible is leading you to come to those conclusions.
So not only dispensationalists can think that way.
I'm giving amillennialists permission to think like dispensationalists without them being dispensational.
Now, listen, I think it's a fascinating conversation.
It's wild, isn't it?
It is. And I think it's one that we're probably going to need to have more of. But what I love at it at its core is that, too, as you know, some of you may have got lost at the beginning or halfway through this episode, whatever, you know, like zodiac stars, Pisces a year, whatever. At the end of it, what Doug's heart is and what I appreciate what this whole conversation is about is we're trying to just make sense of our world and our place in the world and how this is all playing out. And it helps. Doug, it can get discouraging, man. I just kind of feel like, what are we doing? Like, this just feels like everything's in chaos. And this is exactly how the early church felt. I mean, I think I will argue this strongly. I think the early church was really discouraged. They were really discouraged. And how do you not come to that conclusion when you read Peter, when you read some of the passages, the book of Revelation? It's like they feel like the evil is exploding and the church is just getting done. I mean, dude, these people were getting burned at the stake, man. I mean, they're getting eaten by animals. This was not a... It's not what the American Christians are experiencing. And so I think that as we read these texts and we start seeing the growth of evil and the growth of pagan, dude, witchcraft is on the rise. Have you gone through Netflix or any of those streaming services lately, Doug, and seen how many witch shows there are?
Trust me, I know, man. Like there is an evil satanic agenda that's associated with so much of what's happening in our culture. And you know, look, even if people get lost in what we're talking about, what we're trying to do is give people permission to think outside of a box within the confines of solid theology that doesn't say one way or another how you have to think about these things.
That's right.
And there's a great freedom that comes along with that. And with great freedom comes great responsibility, right? We're not trying to...
I think Uncle Ben.
We're not trying to... we don't want to be irresponsible with thinking about these things, but man, there is just a tremendous need for people to think about the supernatural evil that is around them and not to ignore it and not to use some theological doctrine to cause them to not think about it. You know, we can do better than that.
Yeah. Amen to that. And the whole point of this podcast is thinking about our world from both dimensions, the physical dimension and the spiritual dimension. That's right. Man, super nerdy podcast, super fun. This could go on so much longer. But we're going to close it down because you and I both need to go have dinner with our families. And so it's later for us. But the two longer episodes in a row, some of you have been asking for longer episodes. So there you go. But thanks for listening. And whether we pick up on Revelation or not, we might take a small break because I have a couple of topics that I want to discuss with Doug. It's going to be more of a conversation, just thinking through these topics. For instance, things like the gods and the divine council and how that plays out in politics. Ooh, that'd be fun. So stay tuned for that. If you want to join the conversation and ask Doug 1,000 more questions, go over to his website, douglasvandoorne.com. And you can sign up for, Lord willing, it'd be available. You can sign up for the Reformed Friends. So, all right. Thanks, Doug. We'll talk to you guys soon.